an attempt to allow women to have equal pay as men. Republicans apparently believe, including the female Republicans on the Hill, that women are less than men and should be treated less than men and should, I guess, be barefoot and pregnant all the time. You know, it's not much of an exaggeration. As I talk about the Equal Pay Act and what the Republicans did to filibuster it yesterday. Other things going on, we have the Pentagon not only allowing criminals to be in our military, because after all good citizens have already joined, or most of us refusing to serve, but they're also continuing to hide funerals. It's interesting, right here outside of Washington, D.C., in Arlington National Cemetery, even when the family expressly requested that the press be allowed to film the horrible funeral of a young man recently killed in Iraq, they still kept the press out. We'll talk about that. What else is going on? We have the Millionaires Amendment. Do you know about this? This is a provision going before the United States Supreme Court now that would try to equalize the fact that if you're rich in America and you run for office, you've got a lot more chance of getting your message out than if you're poor. The Supreme Court will not. Well, we'll see what they're going to do. I mean, it's a basic free speech case. It seems quite obvious to me that there's no problem allowing poor people to have the same access as the rich. We'll see whether the Supreme Court sees it that way. I want to talk about that. And also about the new video that has come out of the Syrian nuclear reactor, complete with North Koreans in the reactor and designing a reactor that is virtually piece by piece the same as the Yongbyon nuclear plant. It's fascinating. We now know that in 2001, when Israel first said to the United States that Syria has a nuclear reactor, the Bush administration, get this, the Bush administration was incredulous. They said to Israel, you know, I don't know about that. I don't know if there's WMDs. I don't know if there's nuclear weapons in Syria. Yes, the Bush administration. Can you prove it to me? So Israel went out, risked, I'm sure, who knows, the lives of spies, and brought back a video. Brought back a smoking gun, and then destroyed the plant. Imagine if our officials had demanded a smoking gun in Iraq before we had invaded. It's pretty clear that we could never have invaded Iraq. So I want to talk about all of that, and also want to take your calls at 877-4-HEAD-ON. See what's on your mind, 877-443-2366. Let's start, though, with what happened in Pennsylvania, because I know a lot of people are worried, and I have my own concerns. Obviously, we Democrats are fighting each other, and John McCain seems to be picking up the pieces. And there is a problem with that, no doubt. The main problem, the main concern, obviously, is that people who are supporting their candidate so much that they don't recognize that the second-best candidate is pretty good, actually is very good. And I know I've said this many times here on the Inside Scoop before, but it always bears repeating. 95% of the things Hillary Clinton stands for and the things Barack Obama stands for are identical. Whether it's the environment, whether it's guns, whether it's civil rights, whether it's the economy, whether it's the war in Iraq, whether it's abortion, you name the issue, and they're very, very close. Even on health care, they're very, very close. So I am concerned when I hear some of the Clinton supporters in Pennsylvania talk about, well, if I don't get to Hillary Clinton, then I may vote for McCain or may stay home. Just as I've heard Obama supporters say, if I don't get Obama, then I may stay home. Folks, they are very, very similar. And there are differences, but most of them are in personality. Most of them are in the way they get their ideas across. On the issues, they're very close. So that's the thing that most concerns me. And also, I guess, the way that the media helps divide us by class and race. I wonder, prior to exit polls, if we would even have known who's voting for Obama, who's voting for Hillary Clinton. It does seem, based on these polls, that yes, she is getting more of the white working class, the poorer people. Maybe sort of the old John Edwards vote seems to finally clearly being going over to Hillary Clinton. It would be interesting if John Edwards finally were to make an announcement how, if this could change. I mean, the North Carolina primary is coming up. It's the next big one, along with Indiana. It's May 6th. It's just 2 weeks from now. Here's John Edwards' last chance to really make a difference in this race. I think if he were to endorse Obama, that could just about put it away. Now, I don't know, maybe John Edwards wants to be either one's vice president, but if he ever wants to make a chance, to make a choice that has a chance, well, he needs to get on the ball and do it. These are his voters that are turning over to Hillary right now. And, of course, Barack Obama's voters, because they're more educated, it's seen as a bad thing. Republicans, it's interesting, I think, are heir to the old Know-Nothing Party of the 1830s in America, a party that proudly was so anti-intellectual, as well as being, by the way, anti-Catholic, anti-Semitic. Maybe that goes along with being anti-intellectual, anti-foreigners, that they proudly ran on the banner of the Know-Nothing Party. That's right, K-N-O-W, N-O-T-H-I-N-G, they proudly say, we know nothing, vote for us. And they even got an ex-president, Millard Fillmore, one of the least important presidents of the United States, to run under their banner. Well, it seems that the Republicans are doing the same. And it's amazing to me that they could even make this argument without laughing. Now, I'm sure they are laughing, in the background. But when George Will, that's right, bow-tie-wearing George Will, the person who practically drips scorn on anyone who doesn't know his, polysyllabic vocabulary with, this is the heir to William Buckley, if there ever was one. When he, this pretentious guy, is to suggest that Barack Obama is elitist, you know we're living in Lewis Carroll's world. You know that up is down, left is right, and we're in George Orwell land. Here's the thing. Barack Obama went to Harvard. That's true. He also went to Columbia. He also went to the University of Hawaii, I believe. I need to check out these universities. I'm not sure of all of them. The point is, Barack Obama is no more elitist than the multimillionaires who are far richer than he, who he's running against. What he is a guy who grew up with a single mother and a family that was so poor that at one point they had to get on welfare. Now, who's going to understand the concerns of working Americans better than someone from Barack Obama's background? And the thing that he said, which is that people are bitter at the fact that members of Congress and the government aren't helping them very much, is no doubt true. The part that became controversial, that he has admitted that he misstated, is where he said that people cling to God and cling to guns in their bitterness at the government. Now, that also, in and of itself, maybe not phrased the way it should be, is no doubt true. And people look for things that give their lives stability. And when the government can't be trusted, they can depend on, I guess, even if not their church and their pastor, their own conception of God. Because, no one can change your own conception of God but yourself. So if you depend on something that you yourself have created in your mind or that is true to you, then that's more stable, right? As are your pastimes, as are whether it's hunting with guns or bowling or whatever you do, hanging out with your family, taking care of your family. Those are important things. They are stable. They are less likely to change like the whims of the government. And so now, because Barack Obama went to a bowling alley and had a gutter ball, people are suggesting, oh, he's not a regular guy. George Bush is the regular guy. This patrician, son of a president, grandson of a senator, who was so patrician that he indeed supported the Nazis at one point, because that was what patricians did back in the 30s. This guy who bought lived with a silver spoon his entire life and bought a ranch out in Crawford, Texas in 2000 just so he could use it as a pretend backdrop to run for president and went around collecting brush as if he doesn't have his servants do it, which is, of course, what he does when people aren't looking. This is the true man of the people. To me, it reminds me of when Marie Antoinette went and was trying to feel the pain of the French peasants who were starving at the time right before the French Revolution. So what did she do? She decided to find out what their lives were like. She was going to milk a cow. So she got they got the best yearling heifer in France, and got her her golden stool and her golden bucket, and she went out to feel what the life of a peasant is like. And I'm sure that's how George Bush feels when he goes and clears his brush and pretends to be a man of the people. And yet Obama is so real that he has a hard time faking it, right? I mean, okay, he's not that good at bowling. Let's grant that. Let's accept that as true. He happens to be better at basketball than most of us. Okay. Is basketball not a sport of the people? I mean, when you think about how silly this all gets. And yet, this is classic Republicanism. Classic Republicanism is trying to show that the people who actually support the people are not of the people, and therefore can't be trusted. And the irony is that the real elites in America, a very rich family with the last name of Roosevelt, happen to do more for working class men and women than practically any president before or since. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was of the most patrician class, and frankly, John F. Kennedy was from a fairly rich family too. And yet, they, and particularly Roosevelt, were out there giving poor people a new deal. Maybe it takes someone from patrician class to really feel for the working class. I don't know. But I do know it's not the proper way to judge a candidate. You remember they did this to John Edwards too. Oh, he got a $400 haircut, so therefore he can't represent the working man. But what does John McCain do? John McCain was yesterday in Inez, Kentucky, a tiny little coal town. And instead of talking about Bob Kincaid's favorite issue of mountaintop removal, instead of talking about jobs in the coal plants, John McCain set up his proposals. And what are his proposals? He wants to give tax cuts to people who are making a lot of money. In fact, not a single penny of John McCain's tax cuts would help anyone who earns under $25,000. Guess what? The median household income, the income of the median citizen, the average citizen in Inez, Kentucky, the entire house, is $22,000. So more than half of the people listening to John McCain get nothing from him. He's a man of the people. He wants to cut corporate income taxes. He wants to increase corporate welfare. His proposal to help the people of Inez, Kentucky, who are losing their homes, who are losing their wages, who are losing their factories, who are losing their mountains, his proposal is to help companies depreciate equipment. Ooh, that's going to help Inez, Kentucky. That's going to help the people that don't have health care, that are disabled. Why isn't anyone calling John McCain an elitist? You see, the problem is not that people are rich. As I said, Roosevelt is rich. Heck, the Clintons now have money. John Kerry had money. That's not the problem. And Obama doesn't. I mean, that's the irony of it all. He's the poorest by far of the three candidates. The question is not what you have, but what you'll use. Who you are. Do you have a heart? We all know there are rich people with hearts, and there are rich people with no heart. Look at the difference between Roosevelt and Dick Cheney. There are poor people with heart and poor people without heart. But what they're doing, obviously, is they're trying to distinguish, trying to drive poor working class, let's say it, white people, white straight people, white straight Christian people, we might as well say it all. They're trying to say to poor white, well, not necessarily Southern, let's say rural, poor white rural Christian straight people, don't trust the Democrats, even though they will help you economically, because Democrats support equal rights for people. They want equal rights for gay people. They want equal rights for black people. They want equal rights for women. They don't want religious discrimination. Democrats don't support hate. And you want a candidate that supports hate. You want a candidate that claims to be all sweet and nice, but at the same time protects white, poor, Christian, straight people from all those non-Christian, gay, non-white people who want some kind of equality in America. Divide and conquer. Divide and conquer. This is actually what rich whites have done to poor whites for a long time in the South, right? They have very clearly said that, tried to turn poor white people against black folk, because after all, then they won't go against the rich white people. Did you know that in the antebellum South, in the Confederacy, only 1 in 4 white people even owned slaves? And most of those only owned 1 or 2. The plantation owners were far less than 10% of the white population. So think about it. You had a whole group of white people fight and die for other white people. 3/4 of the white South didn't own a slave. Who the heck were they fighting for in the bloodiest war in American history, where 1 out of every 50 people were killed? 2% of Americans were killed in the Civil War. Now, you know, as awful as slavery is, you can see how a slave owner would fight to protect his interests, I guess. But why does the poor white man fight to protect the rich white man? And why does this continue today? Bob Kincaid, by the way, informs me it's Inez, not Inez, and that I shouldn't sound like an elitist. I'm sorry, Bob. I have not been to Inez, Kentucky. I apologize. But is that the problem? I mean, I could just see that, right? If you can't pronounce the name of the town, well, heck, I know people think that there's a state called Nevada. There isn't. It's called Nevada. And the capital of South Dakota, my friend, is not Pierre. It's Pierre. I know I've been there. I've never been to Inez, Kentucky. But I want you to think about the larger point here. Because the question is, why are Republicans always trying to divide us? Barack Obama became famous in 2004 talking about the fact that there is no red state America and there's no blue state America. There are gay people in red state America. There are people who go to church in blue state America. Stop trying to divide us with all this artificiality. And yet Republicans are very clear to take areas that are pro-democratic, whether it's African Americans, whether it's New Yorkers and Californians, whether it's Jews, whether it's Latinos, whether it's women, whether it's labor unions, teachers, to take all of the Democratic Party's main constituents and say, well, they're not American. Teachers aren't American. Teachers unions, labor unions, black people. Yes, there's racism in it. Yes, there's sexism in it. Of course that's all there. And some of it is regionalism. There's always been regionalism in America. But there's always been a feeling of people, particularly in rural areas, that, you know, you can't trust them city folk. And there are many city folk, I guess, that feel the same way. You can't trust them rural folk. And, you know, stereotypes happen. I'm sure there's many rural people who have been to New York City or heard tales of people been to New York City, or as they say in Tennessee, been to Memphis, which is a huge city compared to the towns around it, and got tricked by some city slicker. I'm sure that's happened on occasion. And I'm sure there are city folk who've been out there in rural Georgia and Alabama and been stopped by a police officer who mistreated them. Or by some hick, I guess. Yeah, that prejudice is there too. But you know what? There are a lot of good Americans in rural areas and in the cities, in the North and in the South. You'd be surprised, I think, if you hadn't been to New York City, how friendly some New Yorkers can be. And yes, you'd be surprised if you hadn't been to Inez, Kentucky. Sorry, Bob. Inez, Kentucky. How friendly some of them can be. Just as if you were prejudiced against gay people or against, frankly, fundamentalist Christians, you'd be surprised by how friendly some of them can be. When will we stop judging people on the basis of superficialities? When will we finally learn, as Martin Luther King tried to teach us, about judging Americans by the content of their character? Peggy Noonan writes about the real America. She calls it, quote, a healthy and vibrant place full of religious feeling and cultural energy and Bible study and garage bands and sports love and mom love and sophistication and normality, unquote. Peggy Noonan was Ronald Reagan's speechwriter. Do you hear what she's saying? You got to be religious. You got to study the Bible to love your mother. You have to be normal. Think about that word, normal. Is anyone in America normal? What does it mean to be normal? Well, let's go through it. You got to be white and straight and Protestant Christian, and you have to go to church, and you have to be married, and you have to have kids, of course, and you have to be in good health, and you can't be disabled, and you can't be really poor, that's for sure. What else? You have to believe in God. You have to else to be normal in Peggy Noonan's America. You have to be white. Certainly. You can't be from a foreign country. What else? Have I gotten down to 1% of Americans yet? At the end, of course, you have to be a Republican. What is this idea of normal? I thought America was all about the melting pot, the mosaic, the idea that part of what America is, yes, we know the word sauna from the Finnish language, and we know all about Irish pubs and Chinese food and jazz music from African Americans and a good corned beef sandwich from Jewish delis. I mean, isn't that what America is about? Isn't that what makes us unique? Isn't that what makes us, indeed, here comes my patriotism, the best country on earth? The very fact that we are not limited to one identity, to one idea of what is good. That yes, some of us go to churches, and yes, some of us don't. Yes, some of us go bowling, and some of us play basketball. And some of us have two-parent families, and some of us have one-parent families. And some of us are healthy, and some of us are sick. And some of us, well, are good people, and some of us are not. Is it that hard to understand? See, I think every American in their soul, at the heart, when they think about it, they get it. Even the most racist person, I guess they're extremes. There are people who are so racist that they're absolutely irretrievable. But most even racist people, I think you'll find, have met one black person, one Asian person, one Jewish person, maybe even one gay person, who they think is not such a bad person. It is said, I don't know if it's true, it doesn't matter to me if it's true, but you know, even Hitler had a Jewish doctor, I don't know if that's true. But the point is still true, that people understand at the end of the day that people are people. So I want you to watch as this election goes through, how the Republicans will seek to divide us. They understand that if you look at pure economic terms, 90%+ of Americans should support the Democrats. So they're not going to look at economic terms, right? John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, the same guy who called Obama an elitist, was just a few days ago gathering with Washington lobbyists, Capitol Hill, who largely fund McCain's campaign. Now, how is it for the Republicans that the CEOs of telecommunications companies, they're normal America, they're the ones we have to use tax dollars to support, but not a guy who hasn't bowled before? I mean, they're even trying to fake it, just like George Bush faked Crawford, right? Did you hear about Cindy McCain's recipe for, I forgot which, but she copied it from the Food Network? Look, if you care about religion, if you care about guns, I don't think Obama is going to change your life very much. The Republicans are constantly trying to scare voters. But what is Obama going to do about religion? He has his own religion, which has been controversial. But what's he going to do? What's Dennis Kucinich going to do? I mean, we don't have to talk about Obama. Let's go as far left as you want to go. You name for me one Democratic public official in the nation, member of Congress, senator, I don't think there's a state legislator who would close down churches. What are people worried about? If they want to enforce their particular brand of Christianity by forcing teachers to recite it in public schools, okay, Obama's not going to do that. You know what? McCain probably won't do it either. And you know what? You probably don't want it to happen with your children, even if you're a fundamentalist Christian, if you got a Catholic teacher talking about the Pope in your public school. We don't want state teaching us religion, do we? So if we all agree that the state shouldn't teach us religion and shouldn't fund religion, and I know those of you that support the faith-based initiative, you conservatives out there, you love the government funding your religion, but you don't like the government funding the Nation of Islam. You don't like the government funding Buddhists or polygamists, unless you are a polygamist or a Buddhist. So, who cares? Why is it that they had, I forget the name of the show on which network, CNN, MSNBC, it wasn't Fox. They had a forum where they asked Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama their views on the Holy Spirit. Hello? Hello? I mean, it's interesting, I guess, to know where someone's coming from religiously, but I don't want that in a political season. Does it matter how Hillary Clinton treats or believes in the Holy Spirit? And on guns. On guns. What is this distinction between Democrats and Republicans on guns that causes, oh, poor people in West Virginia, who used to be reliable Democrats. Remember, West Virginia voted for Michael Dukakis in 1988 when only like five states did. To now be so overwhelmingly Republican, even though, let's face it, they need the economics of the Democratic candidates. The government's going to take away our guns. No, they're not. No, they're not. West Virginia is not the District of Columbia, which has had a high murder rate until they banned handguns, and you could still own a rifle in D.C. West Virginia is West Virginia. It's going to have its own gun laws. And what are the things that Democrats want? Well, they don't want crazy people to own guns. Now, find your favorite gun nut and ask your favorite gun nut to justify why someone who's mentally ill should own a gun. And let me suggest to you that I don't care how much they love their guns, they're going to have a hard time justifying that one. And ask your favorite gun nut why people with long, violent criminal records should own a gun. Again, I think you'll find even your gun nut having trouble defending that. What is it the Democrats want to do? They want to do background checks. You might have to wait a few days, maybe even up to, oh my God, a week, before you can get your gun, while they make sure that you don't have a mental illness and you don't have a violent criminal background and you haven't been regularly beating up your wife. Is that too much to ask? Is that why people are going to vote against their economic interests for John McCain in November? I mean, I think people really think the Democrats are going to pack up their guns and cart them away. But they're not. The most extreme thing any Democratic presidential candidate has ever proposed with regard to guns, I think, was probably Al Gore in 2000 when he suggested that guns be registered. Well, cars are registered. It's true. Uncle Sam knows where my car is, or at least who it's registered to, and if I hit someone with it, someone could get my license plate number and catch me. And I don't see too many people complaining about that. And I got news for you. Cars do things other than kill people. Yeah, they kill people, but they also drive you places. Guns kill people too. Is that so extreme? So all this talk, well, you know, we're Democrats, they're elitists. What's it really about? It's divide and conquer, my friends. It's the same thing that happened during the Civil War when one quarter of white Southern whites convinced the other three quarters to fight to the death to protect the right of those rich people to own other human beings. And they're still doing it, and they'll keep doing it, and they will always do it until we learn our lesson. So I don't care whether you support Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. You know, it was a hard choice for me, too. I ended up supporting Obama. If you call in and you want to discuss your choice and you support Hillary, I might try to convince you. But you know what? I don't care. I really don't. But you got to pull the lever for the Democrats in the fall. And you've got to talk to your friends and family. And you know who I'm talking about. Those people who say, if Obama's not the nominee, I'm not going to vote. If Clinton's not the nominee, I'm not going to vote. Obama's a closet Muslim. Clinton's a who knows what. Come on. Talk to your friends and family. Don't let them get mixed up in this divide and conquer. I want to take a quick break, give you a chance to call in if you want to comment on what I just said at 877-4-HEAD-ON. And if not, when I come back, there's a bunch of other stuff I want to talk about. Everything from the Millionaire's Amendment to the Equal Pay Act to the hidden funerals of the Pentagon. 877-4-HEAD-ON, 877-443-2366. We'll be right back after this.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine, with my progressive point of view, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. The Pledge of Allegiance is creating an uproar in a high school in southern Wisconsin. Not the pledge itself, but the language it's recited in. For many years now, Edgerton High School has allowed students in its Spanish class to recite the pledge in Spanish over the intercom one day of the school year. Well, after Spanish students recited the pledge on March 11th, some white parents demanded that the Spanish teacher, the principal, and the superintendent be fired. The superintendent, Dr. Norman Fjellstad, has even been physically threatened. "It's not been fun," he told me, explaining, "When I went to vote, I was confronted. When I went to the grocery store, I was confronted." He added, "They want me removed from my position unless I'm willing to put in writing that this will never happen again, and I won't do that. We don't allow bullying in our schools," he said, "and I won't be bullied by this." Good for Superintendent Fjellstad for holding his ground against the Yahoos, though he may yet be overruled by the school board. Is this what we've come to in this country? Have ignorance and bigotry and xenophobia and blind patriotism finally triumphed over education, tolerance, and free speech? I sure hope not. I'm Matt Rothschild, and that's how I see it.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. There are other things going on. Let's talk about the Millionaire's Amendment, because I think some of you may not know the details of what that is, and it's going up before the United States Supreme Court. The Millionaire's Amendment is one of the few things that got through a Republican Congress. It got through, by the way, as part of the McCain-Feingold Act, and only because the Democrats... frankly, it's one of their only victories in the Republican Congress. You may not know that in Congress, if the Speaker of the House does not want a bill to come forward, it does not come forward and cannot be passed into law with only one exception, and that is if a majority of people, 218 members of Congress, actually sign their name to a discharge petition. So a majority says they support it and sign their name on it, then you can force it against even the Speaker's will. And that's what happened with McCain-Feingold, and that's what happened with this Millionaire's Amendment. Now, what is this amendment? What this amendment does is it says that an exception shall be made to public financing when somebody spends a lot of their own money. For example, the man who is suing right now in the United States Supreme Court, Jack Davis, who is a multimillionaire. The rule was that if he spent $350,000 of his own money, he has to notify his opponent, and the limitations on how much that opponent can raise are increased. In other words, if the rule is that you could only get, say, $2,000 per person, per individual, which I support because I don't want rich people controlling candidates too much, but you're up against a candidate who has, oh, $20 million of his own money and spends it, and it reaches a certain level, then you, the candidate who's funded by others, can raise those limits to, say, $6,000 so that people can give up you to $6,000 a person. And what does that do? It allows the underfunded candidate to compete more equitably. It doesn't give any money to the underfunded candidate. In fact, the money is raised from private sources just as well. It doesn't stop the free speech of the multimillionaire. The multimillionaire can continue to spend as many tens of millions of dollars as he or she wants to do. What it does is it says if a millionaire is spending $10 million on his own campaign, running against someone who is not a millionaire, the person who's not a millionaire can then raise more money than would otherwise be allowed under public financing campaign laws. It sounds not even controversial, right? I mean, believing in free speech as I do, it doesn't stop the free speech of the millionaire. It doesn't stop the free speech of the publicly funded person. Indeed, what it does is it allows the person raising funds to compete on more equal ground. Well, that's not good enough for Jack Davis. No. Jack Davis, who ran for a seat in the New York State House unsuccessfully as a Republican, is upset that the mere fact that he was spending millions of his dollars allowed his opponent to raise more money per person than would otherwise have been allowed. Yes, he's actually making the argument that that is a violation of his free speech, that his free speech gives him a right to say that rich people can speak and poor people can't. And when poor people are given a right to speak, Jack Davis and the Republican Party argues that when you allow poor people a right to express their views, well, that harms rich people, and therefore it must be outlawed. Now, in a normal country with a normal Supreme Court that follows, hey, the Constitution of the United States, Jack Davis would be laughed out of court. I'm worried about this Supreme Court. I figure four justices are already lost. The four extreme right-wingers, people who are, you know, far to the right of John McCain. I'm talking, of course, about Scalia and Thomas and Alito and Roberts. People who are far to the right of the Republican Party. But maybe Anthony Kennedy, someone who is only a conservative Republican, only someone who believes that the Supreme Court should choose the president if the people choose Gore, maybe he will save us? I don't know. I'm worried, but I want you to watch this case because to me it typifies everything that's wrong. The argument that somehow a rich person is denied free speech if a poorer person is allowed to raise enough money to partially compensate for the wealth difference. Wow, the audacity of that argument. Equally audacious, indeed probably more so, was the filibuster of the Equal Pay Act that occurred just yesterday. Again, I don't think it got much news in the press. You know, of course, why this is necessary. See, we have Title VII, passed back in the 1960s when Americans, I guess, cared about civil rights and equal protection under the law. Now we know, I guess, that women don't need to get the same as men. They don't need the same pay as men. They're women, right? You wouldn't think anyone would make that argument anymore. Well, then you don't know the case of Lilly Ledbetter. Lilly Ledbetter had been doing the same job as her male counterparts, indeed doing a better job than her male counterparts, and have been earning less than they for years, for decades, and she never knew about it. The men had kept their salary secret, knowing that she worked harder, she did a better job, and she was in a better class job. They weren't going to tell her their paycheck, and she didn't say hers, and the employer didn't disclose it. And finally, a few months before her retirement, Lilly Ledbetter learned that for a decade, she'd been paid less than the men who were doing ostensibly the same job or actually even a lesser job. So she sued. And the United States Supreme Court held that because everybody lied to her, she loses. That because the company didn't disclose the fact to her that they were discriminating against her until the last minute, she loses. That in other words, if the company had told the truth, she might have won. But if you manage to fraudulently cheat someone, then you win. Cheaters are leaders. What happened? There is a 180-day limit. Very short statute of limitations. 6 months, probably the shortest of any civil action in the United States. But courts for decades, ever since the Civil Rights Act was passed in 1964, have understood that it's based on when you learn you've been discriminated against, right? She learned it recently. She filed within 6 months of learning that she'd been mistreated. But Supreme Court says she couldn't go after the back pay. She didn't know she was being abused. And because she didn't know she was being abused, fraud wins. You got to support the racists. You got to support the sexists. The Supreme Court made clear, sexists are winners, but only if they lie too. Okay, crazy Supreme Court decision. Of course Congress is going to overturn that, right? They can do that because it's statutory authority. This isn't a constitutional question. Congress passes a law just yesterday, and the Republicans filibuster it. Obama and Clinton, to their joint credit, came out from campaigning and voted the right way. The Republicans voted against it. The Republicans seem to feel that not only should sexism be there, not only should women be paid lower than men, but employers who cheat women should be encouraged to lie about it as much as possible. Who's the elitist? The people who think that people should get the same wages for the same work? Or the people who think that if you lie and cheat and mislead your employees, you should make a lot of money doing so? Who's the elitist? And why isn't this big news? Because nothing Obama or Clinton do with regard to religion or guns will affect people's lives 1/100th as much as the Equal Pay Act, which merely says, you know what, get the same pay for the same job. Women who do the same job as men should get the same pay. That affects people's lives. Not Hillary's views on the Holy Spirit. But that won't be in the press. No. We have to talk about Obama's elitism. Meanwhile, the government is doing more secret things. They're, of course, hiding their funerals. Now, that's nothing new. Don Rumsfeld made it very clear he was going to hide funerals. But what makes this case interesting, the case of Lieutenant Colonel Billy Hall, is that his family specifically asked the press to be there. He was buried at Arlington National Cemetery with military honors. He was killed in Iraq. He was laid to rest just yesterday. And the family requested cameras be there. Now, I can understand families mourning, saying, journalists, stay out. I understand that. And I even, although I recognize it's a closer question for me, because I recognize it's something of public interest, but I also want to be kind to the families. At least there, I can understand military officials keeping the media out. But this family wanted the media there. This family requested that the media cover his burial, so that people would know that their son had given his life for this war. And what did the government do? They kept the media 150 feet away. They kept them far enough away that they could not hear any sound from the ceremony. They could merely get a picture from a distance that didn't show a grave or a coffin. Now, here's what's interesting. Arlington's public affairs director, she's new on the job. Her name is Gina Gray. She's the bureaucrat in charge. She tried very, very hard to allow the journalists to attend. So don't blame Arlington. Don't blame the National Park Service. Don't blame the bureaucrats. She was overruled. So the family couldn't allow the media there. Arlington couldn't allow the media there. Everyone wanted the media there, except the Bush administration. The same Bush administration where Don Rumsfeld couldn't take the time to personally sign letters of condolence for the young men and women whose lives were lost in vain due to a war that shows no end. What else are they keeping secret? Well, guess what? They have a new program to spy on us. Yes, yes. No, not the same warrantless surveillance program you've kind of heard vague things about. No, there's a new one. What, you didn't see it in the press when they were talking about Obama's bitterness? Well, apparently the press doesn't think this is that important. But Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff has announced an entirely new domestic satellite surveillance office. Doesn't that sound nice? Now, why do we need domestic surveillance? Listen to this. Because this is great slippery slope stuff. Oh, we need it, he says, because we have to track hurricane damage and monitor climate change. Really? That's why you want it? Because, Chertoff, you could do that without a warrant. Oh, but in the middle of all that, you also want radar and electronic signal and chemical detection and imagery and mapping and all to watch those hurricanes, huh? And it's classified specifically what it will do. You know, I've talked often before about how you cook a frog, but it bears repeating. If you want to cook a frog, you can't throw him in a pot of boiling water. You throw the frog in boiling water, and he will immediately, as quickly as he can, before he is boiled, jump out. Why would he? He's boiling water. Jump. Run. You want to cook a frog? You put him in cold water. And you put the cold water on the stove. The water very slowly heats up to lukewarm, to hot, to boiling. And by the time the frog realizes what's going on, it's too late. He's cooked. Enjoy your frog legs. We're getting cooked in this country, piece by piece, inch by inch. We're getting to the point where our members of Congress are too afraid even to exercise the powers that are clearly granted to them under the Constitution. If you didn't hear my interview on Tuesday with Congressman Bart Sestak of Pennsylvania, please go to the archive. Go to RadioInsideScoop.com. You owe it to yourself. The interview is only 20 minutes long, and then I comment on it for a half hour afterwards. Listen to that interview. Because you will hear a good man. Congressman Sestak is a good man. He wants the troops home from Iraq. He supports democratic causes, but he doesn't want to use his powers under the Constitution to hold the president to account. He wants someone else to do it. He wants the courts to do it. He doesn't want to be seen as partisan. He doesn't want to do his job. And it's not that he's, you know, a coward. This is a man who was a vice admiral of the military. Well, it is cowardice, but cowardice of a different kind. It's not a fear of physical attack. It's a fear of criticism. Why don't Republicans have this fear? When they're all sitting in a room, Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice and John Ashcroft, and deciding which methods of torture to use, should they use the Inquisition techniques or the Nazi techniques, and John Ashcroft, apparently the most liberal person in the room, says history won't judge us kindly for this. Nobody says boo. Nobody says boo. And Bart Sestak is afraid of using Congress's limited power to have a sergeant at arms take one or two people, the president, and hold them until they testify? Yeah, it all comes together. Last week I had Larry Wilkerson on, Colin Powell's chief of staff, Colonel Wilkerson, who said that Colin Powell, he remembers staring outside the window a few months before we invaded Iraq and saying, what if there's nothing there? What if all this discussion on weapons of mass destruction, it turns out that we invade and there's nothing there? Hey, at least he thought about it. Compare that with, for example, what Israel did. Actually went in with spies, got a video, made the incontrovertible evidence, and you know what happened? No country in this world is hated more than Israel. But when Israel bombed Syria's nuclear plant, nobody said boo. The Syrians didn't complain because they knew that they weren't allowed to do that. The Iranians didn't complain. Hezbollah, you name it. Al-Qaeda didn't complain because everyone knew Israel was right. Because the Syrians were caught. Because we had the proof. Because they had the smoking gun. They had the evidence. Imagine if we demanded evidence before we took military action. We wouldn't even be in Iraq today. Is it that much to ask that before you start a war, you have some evidence for what you're doing, for what you're arguing? Look at the difference between these parties. The Republicans, who are preparing to torture people and don't give a damn what the world thinks, and the Democrats, who are afraid to use force, and it's not that much force. They're holding a woman in a congressional office, for God's sake, and they're feeding her until she testifies, which she's required by law to do. They're afraid to do that limited step while George Bush is torturing and murdering innocent people. I think the Democrats need some cojones. Not to break the law, but simply to go and do the things they're already allowed to do. And that's been my argument with the Democratic Party. And then, if you heard yesterday's interview with Cindy Sheehan, you see, I think, people going off too far in the other direction. So upset with the Democrats, as I am, that they're joining with the very people that we shouldn't join with terrorist organizations. Which is just making us, that doesn't help our movement. The trick is, and I think Barack Obama has this trick, frankly, better than anybody else that I've seen in public office, to consistently support what is right, to consistently support the American people, to condemn terrorists when it occurs abroad and at home, torture when it occurs abroad and at home. You can condemn Al-Qaeda and George Bush, and you can still be a patriotic American. We need this kind of truth-telling in our politicians, and I still think Barack Obama will pull it out, become our nominee as someone who uniquely can stand up for not just one kind of American, but for us all. Hope you enjoyed today's show. I will see you next week. For now, this is Mark Levine signing off. Yeah.
listening to The Horn, the Head-On Radio Network.